Hi there, Neverwinterians. This is Axe, a.k.a. Axe Murderer, coming after y'all from the hills outside Santa Barbara, California, because you are listening to the one and only Neverwinter Nights podcast.
This is so exciting. Wow, where to begin?
It's the Neverwinter Nights podcast.
The Neverwinter Nights podcast.
The only podcast for the Neverwinter Nights game series, bringing you news, interviews, reviews, and more for the community by the community. You can find us online at neverwinternightspodcast.com. And now, on to the show.
Hi, everybody. It's Shauna, also known as Cat Dragon Star, and you're listening to episode 124 of the only Neverwinter Nights podcast. Well, here I am, in my cave, all alone, looking around, and guess what? I'm here by myself. All right, it's okay, it's all right. Suck it up. It's all going to be all right. It's going to be all right, and hopefully some handsome knight will come along soon, and I can dine on canned food for dinner tonight. But no, wait, back to the show. Trey's left you in charge here tonight, all alone, all by yourself. Something or other about a small sick child. I think if you dip the small sick child into boiling oil, well, that's going to get you in trouble, so never mind, don't do that. Seriously, I'm sorry to hear that the little one is ill. So tonight, we're going to present part two of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of the Persistent Worlds roundtable that we've presented last week. Obviously easy for me to say. That was a pretty neat and very detailed roundtable that had a lot of good information in it. So I hope you've all listened to it, and then tonight listen to the second part of it, and may you all learn something.
So The scripting affects every world and its own, and without it, there is no way it can exist for a successful time.
Yeah,
I have to agree with that. You know, if you don't keep changing it and adding new stuff in, you know, the world gets stale pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
Even with DMs.
Yep, DMs, that's what we found out. That's why I spent 2 months working on this dynamic spawning system with the database and actually a web admin tool so that DMs could actually go into the, you know, log in on the web portal and, you know, change spawners configurations on the fly and change it real time so that they can go in and actually make those changes without even having to be logged in. You know, that we have all that stuff just to keep things just to, but you can't do that, none of that stuff without scripting. None of it. You know, that's what's so huge about scripting. And, you know, something else, too, is the fact that the people who made the Neverwinter Nights extender and the one for Neverwinter Nights 2, I mean, they opened the floodgates on all the stuff that you can do using the extender. I mean, there's so much good stuff you can do with that as well, even.
Yeah, no doubt.
And that's not even Bioware. That's not a Bioware Obsidian. I mean, that was somebody went out there, you know, and bled about 2 gallons of blood to write that thing. Yeah. That was some insane programming. I just looked at the source code. It's extremely, you know, that's what I do for a living too, and it's extremely advanced. So I really tip my hat to who spent all the time and effort, Papillion and them guys. They really did a phenomenal job.
Yeah, it's a very tedious process to reverse engineer to that level.
Yep,
we were really, really blessed to have that. Papillion, he did the initial testing on our Avalis servers. It was awesome to be able to see that as it came to fruition.
Oh yeah. You've been around for a long time too, and I think it was beforehand. I think he did that like right around that same time. I remember reading some of the forums on there.
Yep.
Yep.
So I got a question for you guys about scripting. Have you ever implemented a scripting system on your server and thought it was great and then ended up trashing it because it was horrible?
Yes.
Or didn't work out to your expectations? The players didn't like it, you know, for whatever reason?
I think so. We've got a couple of systems that never really caught on. we try to do things in iterative, you know, steps though. So it's not as like, here's this dramatic new awesome thing, and then everyone goes meh.
Yeah.
Once in a while we have that sort of thing happen, but it's try to go back to the drawing board or take people's input and make another change and make it better and better. A lot of times what we get is we end up with a system that begins by only being usable by a very small subset of the population.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Right now we have a set of new drop types, and one of them is dropping meat that you can harvest from animals, and there are, if you're a barbarian or a ranger, you can, well, I guess anybody can do it, but not everybody can progress in ability. If you're a barbarian or a ranger, then you can buy some spices and use the meat to create, like, healing kits or sort of field rations that'll give you a boost in strength for a little while, like a potion, that sort of thing. So you can kind of make it on the fly. But right now, it's, like I said, only barbarians and rangers that can really get any progression. And so for a lot of the player base, there's not a whole lot of uptake because they don't have the requisite class. Those of us who are playing a barber or a ranger were able to use it, work out some of the bugs, and eventually we'll probably spread it out to other classes and make it more useful.
Wow. Hello?
Yeah.
No more ideas?
Well, I'm just trying to mull over anything that, you know, I wouldn't say we had ever had to scrap anything, though. I think the one that we had to modify because it was a little too restrictive was, it was an environmental effect. We have part of our, like, the last set of areas that we have revolve around Kania and the Nine Hells. And, you know, if you look at the lore, it's supposed to do, you know, nobody's supposed to be immune to the damage except for the demons and devils that live there. And we have a thing where it's a deep cold. It's a soul-piercing cold. Well, we had put it in there that, you know, you would take so much environmental damage every so often, you know, from the environment to really fully affect where you're at. Well, the idea was good, and it worked out good, but what we end up doing is we end up, you know, penalizing a little extra heavy in certain areas and others. And, you know, it kind of hindered people in their progression. It kind of ruined their experience a little bit. So what we had to do is we had to scale it back a lot. You know, it was fully configurable, but still, it was something we had to make modifications to, even though, just like you had asked, if there's something that, you know, we had thought was a good idea up front, you know, we tested it and stuff, but it wasn't really what the players wanted. So we ended up scaling it greatly back. But that was about the best example that I could give you where we've had to do that.
We made some
reason, the reason I asked. The reason I asked is because I've run across several builders that are really resistant to removing things that are bad because they think they're so good.
That is one of the awesome things about dividing builders from the rest of the team. because the players, and I mean DM staff and the head DM are the people who were supposed to be making decisions about how things work in the world, and the builders are supposed to be, you know, being creative and putting things together for us. But if it's broken, or if people hate it, then we're able to send these guys back to the drawing board and go, look, you need to change this. And that's not a hierarchical responsibility, but it puts the guys who make the decision about what goes into the world are the people who are most involved with the players and not the people who are most involved with the systems.
Yeah, and you don't, it sounds like in your world, you don't really have a boss. You don't have a head guy that, I mean, you have a guy that maybe organizes it, who is, I assume, is you, but you seem to work as more of a corporation type thing where you have a board of directors. You know, there are several modules that work that way, but I would say the vast majority of them are the other way around with the dictator system.
Yeah, we don't have that. Well, we've got a lead producer and a head DM. And then we have a hierarchy of DM structure because we got 20 guys on our DM staff.
Yeah.
And so they go up from you just started DMing, you're only allowed to cookie people, all the way up to you can possess the king of whatever and and make massive changes to political situations in the world and all that sort of thing. But, yeah, lead producer handles the builder side of people, and the head DM deals with the DMs, and then we have a world leader over both of them to kind of make, you know, facilitates between those two people.
Yeah. How do you guys do it, Brian?
We actually have, you know, I'm the actual, what Kama calls the boss man, you know, we have it set up like that where I make the decisions, but I don't do it in a dictatorial standpoint. I mean, what we do is we take tons of feedback from the players themselves. Our forum, that if there's anything that we want to add or remove, we take polls and we listen to the players directly, you know, and as far as implementation is concerned, we have our head DM, which handles the player stuff. As far as development's concerned, you know, that's Calm's area of expertise, and he's over top of the other DMs who, you know, do the other development. So, I mean, we have that kind of a structure. But as far as, like, the decisions I make, they're made through the player's perspective, not through my perspective, because there's things that I've implemented personally. I'm like, eh, I don't know if that's all that good, but I could see their point, and that's what's making most of the players happy. As long as it doesn't disrupt the balance of the server, or our vision, as Doug likes to call it, you know, that's the way we handle things. So, I mean, we do it much more inclusively to the players than what we may even personally do in our own play style, our own design style, as long as it fits the vision of the server, but it pretty much always does. The players are here because they like to play here and they like the idea that what we put out. They really don't suggest things that really go against that. If anything, they want something harder, they want something easier, or if they want this type of feature in the game, we listen. We just spent probably a good, I don't know, 2-3 months just developing all kinds of new things for the server that really were all player-inspired. None of it was inspired from us, and, you know, let's say maybe like 20% of it. The rest of it was from the players and their ideas and suggestions.
Well, we have been recording for an hour. I think we have one more topic to cover, I think. What do you think about monsters? Hello?
What do you think about?
Monsters.
Dude.
How are they supposed to be? What kind of monsters have you encountered in the game world? Or the topic I just posted. The big, the Uber, and how the hell do you kill it? Have you ever encountered something like that?
Usually a module that has something like that is, that's not the only thing that's wrong with it. So I usually don't ever make it that far. You know, I'm usually gone from a server that has something like that before I even meet it because of other problems.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I think that a lot of the things that I probably would say, you know, as far as developing areas and developing things for a server, I think at least half of the time, it goes into the scaling and balancing and difficulty and how unique the mobs are. And you know, because we don't make real Uber stuff, and we're trying to make things where that if you have an average build, you can beat it. And if you're smart with your tactical abilities, you know, in-game, you're able to beat it. You know, the thing of the matter is that if you just go throw areas together, you throw creatures in, when you build your creature, if you build them willy nilly, just start clicking check boxes on all their abilities and not really looking at their AC and their AB and the appropriateness for the level, and not only that, looking at the overall availability of items and things in the server. If you don't have an understanding of the actual makeup of the server, what ends up happening is you have a situation just like Axe was talking about. You have a bigger problem. You have a huge problem because you have all the other stuff that happens, because you're not really, when you're developing stuff, you're not looking at the big picture, and you're not testing enough with the players and yourself to see how easy and or hard something might be.
Yeah, that kind of stuff comes from testing.
Exactly. If it's
and planning, of course.
Oh, the planning is huge. Yep.
If you don't plan your monsters out, they're not going to come out good.
Nope. They're very detailed. Especially you play a lot of Neverwinter Nights 1 yet. And there's a lot more options on Neverwinter Nights 1 to do to a mob than in Neverwinter Nights 2.
I don't have Neverwinter Nights 2, so...
Yeah.
I've never played it.
Well, there's a lot... I know from playing... I've played Neverwinter Nights 1 a lot before I got into 2, and, you know, I will say that there's a lot more that you can add to a mob that really... it makes it that much more intricate and complicated that where, you know, you could really blow the stuff up if you're not careful. I mean... At least with 2, I mean, you have a lot less options that you can get yourself in trouble with. But if you don't have a proper procedure, like, you know, that methodology when you're creating your mobs, like, you know, that's why first thing I did was come up with a methodology of how I build them from scratch. I built everyone from scratch, from their appearance to their armor, the tailor, everything. But the biggest thing at the time isn't that. The biggest thing at the time is balancing it out and making it so the players don't come in and get their head knocked off.
Yeah. In fact, it's not a bad idea to have a module. I set up a little module just for testing, and you know, where I can just whip up a monster from scratch. Not have to worry about all the appearance stuff. Just, you know, get him combat balanced, and then I have a blueprint to work from, and throw that in my palette. And then whenever I need to make that type of monster, I'll drop one of those in and just change its appearance, and it's ready to go.
Well, I don't know. Whenever I make a monster, I usually make a blueprint like you do, a first level monster. And when I will upgrade it to the more tougher version, and more tougher as well, until the maximum possible level of that monster could be exist on the server.
Yeah.
And always test them myself, because I know if I can handle them with my medium characters, which I usually build them for more roleplay than fighting. Yes. I know that a player can handle that monster alone, even if it will be a rogue or a fighter. The real problem was with the mages, but with something else.
I didn't catch that.
The real problem...
Your accent throws me sometimes.
Yeah, the real problem was with mages. The warlocks, the sorcerers, the wizards.
Yeah.
To find the monster that will be good for them.
See, you find it harder to balance them when there's a mage on the other end.
If he's alone, yes. How can you balance something for a mage when a monster can chop him up in 5 seconds without on high levels even, if he's not ready?
The way I view something like that is if you build a monster that's balanced for, say, let's say a fourth level fighter, he's also balanced for like an eighth level mage.
Yeah, but it doesn't.
So that's the way. I don't like to try and balance it for the same level across all classes, because I don't think that you can do that.
There is some things you can do to kind of balance things out. Like, for instance, like if you're sending your mobs to have ungodly hit points because you're warrior classes are kicking up so much damage, it might be a good idea to look at what kind of damage options you're giving out to your warrior classes. Like, how many damage types can you add to an item for the forge? Because if you're giving them too much, and that's why they're cutting down your mobs in 2 seconds, but a wizard gets destroyed because, you know, one evocation spell is capped out, or, you know, they can only do so much damage, then that's a balance issue otherwise. So what we've done is we've, you know, lowered hit points down a lot, you know, make it where that a mage is more, you know, effective, and or, like, watch their hit dice. One of the biggest problems, especially in Neverwinter 2, is that you got to watch the hit dice of your mobs. If you have their hit dice sky high, like, well, not even sky high, if even appropriate, The saves, they go out, they go off the charts if the players aren't effective enough against them. So you have a wizard that's just worthless pretty much. So what you do is you lower their hit dice as far as in the tool set. You lower their hit dice, but maybe increase their stats so they still have a higher AC than they, or a higher hit points that they would have otherwise at that lower level. So that it appears to be a higher level creature, even though hit dice are low, hit points are a little lower, and they're a little softer to hit.
Yeah, especially for the mages.
Yep, it really makes a big difference. And you have a mage that doesn't feel like, hey, I'm worthless.
Yeah,
I just casted a Greater Isaac Missile Storm at something, and I've done 100 damage, but the thing's got 700 hit points.
Yeah,
and then they're worthless. So
now on the topic of mages, how do you handle the spells, getting the spells back? The whole resting thing with mages. Because I've been to a lot of servers that try different things to allow mages to be powerful but not endless spell supplies going. So how do you guys handle that?
We handle it just by the simple fact that you can rest. You'll get your spells back anytime you rest. There's no limitation on rests. But the way that our areas are designed, it is hard to rest in some places. I mean, just because if you look at realistically, you're going into a very hostile area, and it's not impossible to rest.
So you have an ambush system.
Yeah, we have more of an, well, yes and no. I mean, we do have a system of trigger spawns, and we also have the standard time spawn system. So that, you're going to always, in certain areas, you're going to run across X and Y mobs. But there are special traps and little things that if you maybe open a sarcophagus, you might have a little problem on your hands type of things too.
Yeah.
So, that we have the mixture. But it is, if you're smart, you can rest in appropriate places prior to getting there and set yourself up. Now, it might be a long, sweated process to get to the end sometimes because it's, there's mobs all over the place, trolling the place. You might want to plan your rests out. But we don't limit the players how many times they can rest per day. We let them rest as many times as they possibly can if they want to, and it allows them to get through like that balance issue. It gives them a little extra jump on things because of things maybe a little bit harder for them as a caster versus a melee type.
Yeah. Well, what I did in one module that worked out pretty good was just for a small group of friends, so I don't know how it would work out on a PW. But what we did is we set up spots in the module where you could rest. And you had to be in one of the spots to rest. Like you had to go into the inn area or there was a campsite trigger out in one of the wilderness areas. And you could, as long as you were inside the trigger, you could rest. And it wouldn't rest out, and that kind of thing. And also there was each area you could also rest anywhere you wanted, but if you did, there was a chance. There were area variables and stuff that controlled how much of a chance and stuff. But usually, out in the wilderness, there's a pretty good chance that you can try to rest. But if you do, something's going to come and wake you up, and you're going to have to fight them in a weakened state.
Yep.
And then what we did to control, there's like a dungeon. It's a hard place to set up a campsite in a dungeon because it doesn't really make sense. But you can't really have it so that mages can only go a few areas and then they're out of spells and they can't get them back again. So the way we handled that was, we did several things. The same thing with fighters. They'd run out of hit points. And they have no cure spells left or anything or any healing kits. And, if they can't find a place to rest, they're in trouble. So what we would do is I remember one thing we had is these little floating butterfly things. And if you ran through them, then it would, automatically restore some of your health or give you some spells back or something like that.
Like a checkpoint?
You didn't have to actually rest. You just had to find the butterfly swarm, And it worked out pretty good, because people were... It prevented mages from just constantly resupplying those ninth-level spells, and everybody got a little bit of healing and rest back and,
well,
and
I used to
at the right place.
I used to do something different. I used to sell potion that players would come, would buy it and drink it, especially mages and clerics, but it would cost them 500 coins per potion and 100 XP points to use it. It will restore their entire spell book in an instant.
I see. That's an interesting idea. Never seen that done.
Me neither. That's good.
It's very good.
I said Axe's idea was good too. I mean, both of you. I never thought about it either way. That's pretty interesting ways to look at resting and stuff.
The potions, because the same thing that Axe said, clerics and the casters lose their spells very fast for areas. And they have to regenerate their spells or through resting or through other means. So if you limit the resting to some areas, you cannot give them another. You have to give them another option to restore their abilities. One is through what X did, and another what we did is give them a potion which they will use to restore it, but with a price, because they will strain. There will be like a description using or description on the potion using on your own consideration will strain your mind beyond.
Ouch.
Cut that out.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. That's another good idea. I think he just dropped out.
No, he didn't. If he did, we would.
Oh no, he's there.
If he did, we would drop out. I too had a phone call a moment ago, but it was a little bit less sound. It's kind
of. Yeah. Well, one of the things I liked about the way we did that was we could actually control how wounded the party was by where we placed the camps, and it was a nice thing to be able to do, because you could have this really long, you know, multi-area thing that they have to go through. Like, well, we had this one tunnel that they had to go under the mountain to get to the other side of the map, and
it was a long, long journey.
It was probably maybe, I don't know, 15 areas. It was a lot, you know. They weren't huge areas, but there was a lot of them to go through. And we put several spawns along the way and a couple of bosses and stuff. And I think there was even a side quest where you could take a side passage and go do a side quest while you were down there. And by limiting where they could rest, not when they could rest, it was really easy to say, oh, look, they're going to be, you know, by the time they get to area 7, you know, the mages are probably going to be getting low, and, you know, if they don't have the healing kits with them, then some of their fighters might be hurt, and this might be a good place to put something. You know, it allowed us to have more flexibility in the design of the encounters that they're going to meet on the way, because we could guesstimate how wounded the party would be at certain points, since they weren't able to rest at will.
I used to make underground worlds like a maze, so it's times people got lost in them without guidance and no exit. So, I don't know, we used to make something for dwarves so we can get around, but the others, complete darkness, kobolds everywhere, goblins, and orcs. Goblin and orcs everywhere, and this is a level 7 area, so they are pretty tough. And you have to maneuver your way. You can go around an encounter, you can go through the encounter, you can do everything you want, just as long as you do it. But the resting, we didn't see as putting what you did with. You did it on the single adventure for a group, right, X? Your adventure.
What's that?
you put the resting rules for the single adventures that you had, not for the PB.
Well, it was like, I mean, you could rest any time you wanted, but you just couldn't. You had to be.
We did the same thing with the. We just also limited the rest to 20 minutes. You cannot rest 1 hour.
No, I did.
After
we didn't put that in.
At least 1 hour after. But
yeah.
And that's why the potion comes in. And
I see.
If you rest in the wilderness without somebody standing guard, there is a good chance where some wild animals or a patrol of orcs or goblins will wake you up.
Yeah.
So Brian got called away.
No, I just got back. I just got back. Thanks.
So.
Well, all those are good ways to go. What kind of rest systems does? Do you guys play a lot?
I didn't play for
much.
Several months, but yeah.
How about you, Brian? Do you play still or?
Well, most of my time is in development and playing, like DMing right now. I mean, I get to play every so often. I play on our server primarily. I mean, I check out a couple others here and there just to see what's going on and for some ideas and stuff.
Yeah. So as a player, what kind of rest systems do you dislike?
Personally, I dislike anything that restricts. Like, as long as you can rest, if there's nothing around you and you're free and clear and you've worked your way through something, I'd like to be able to take a rest. I don't like the limited amounts per day rest systems, and that's primarily why I don't think we implemented it, because it was too restrictive for what we were trying to do. But I see the reason for them, and I totally agree with them, too, at the same time. I just personally prefer not having that.
Well, the rest system is something that, for me, I don't mind having resting rules or restrictions, but I think that a lot of places go overboard with it, and they make it too restrictive.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, 40 minutes is too long in a computer game.
Mm-hmm.
You end up what ends up happening is you get to a state where you can't survive until you rest, and because the timer won't let you, you can't really go anywhere. You have to sit there and do nothing until that time comes around, and that's a really, really bad thing for players, in my opinion. Is having a situation where they're not doing anything; they're just sitting there waiting for some restriction to end. That's really bad.
I don't know. I had a limited for 20 minutes, but I never had a problem with that. Until they get from encounter to encounter, it will at least pass about 15 minutes or so. And the loot gathering and RPing and so on, with 20 minutes have passed. They have the potion.
Yeah, giving them that potion option is a good thing, because at least they can decide for themselves, oh, I don't want to wait that whole time.
I will take the potion, lose 100 XP that I can regain in a moment, and will be...
Yeah, that's a good system, I like that.
Yeah, it's very innovative, extremely.
For all those builders out there that are using a timed rest system, that would be a really excellent addition to your world, is to give somebody a potion where they can rest out off the clock, but it'll cost them some
XP.
Cost them some blood,
Yeah. Initially, it was supposed to be 500 XP when I said, wait, to the coder that worked with me. What have I 500 XP? How long did you play on my server? He said 6 months. How long does it take to gather your 500 XP between rests? He said 4 hours. Okay.
Don't you scale it by level?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Because I would think, 500 for a level 1 guy is shitload. But 500 for a level 10 guy is pocket change.
Yep.
so you should scale those.
The thing is, the low-level players never got to the point where they need to use it.
Yeah.
Even the mages. Mostly,
and it's probably, they probably can't afford it anyway, right?
Yes, 500 coins.
500 coins?
Yes. Per potion. It's expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive.
But a good money scene.
You might want to grab one, you know, have one in your inventory just in case.
Yeah. Or five.
That's a good way to go. I like that. I really do. I like that. I like that idea.
Brian, I have a question. How do you manage a money sink on your server?
How do I manage what?
Money sink. Well, you
players... He's asking about the economy.
Yes.
Oh, economy, yeah. We have, I mean, there's a couple ways. I mean, you got to look at, the first thing we do is, we know, I could tell you to a T, especially because of the database system we have, now how much gold that we are giving in ranges for each individual kill, for each individual type of creature, and wherever it is. So we have a range automatically for all that stuff. We have capped purchase prices from the stores, so that, you know, no matter how much appraisal you have, you're really not going to get a whole lot extra, so that you can't get infinite gold, stupid stuff like that. We also have full tracking of how much gold is accumulated to the players, and we have it gold by account and gold by character, and you can see, you know, all the different tallies, and we have graphs and stuff that we see all that with, well, the reports.
Wow.
Run. Number two is,
you know,
that
just want to interrupt for a second.
Sure.
It would be really useful to the community if you could package that kind of information up and put it out maybe on the vault where other builders can see it.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a bad idea. I mean, once,
no?
Yeah, actually, it's not a bad idea. I already have all the codes written and everything like that, so I end up NWNX stuff, so it should be straightforward.
Yeah, well, you're capturing so much good information there. It would be nice to put that out so people could see it.
Oh yeah, the data, all the stuff that I capture in database is huge. I just added this stuff for the last like 3-4 months, and it's been amazing, the stuff that you can see. But the thing is like with that system, I can see how much players have. I can see how much players are spending on, roughly spending, you know, just because I know the cost of the goods throughout all the stores, and the stuff that I know they're going to be buying, like potions and stocks and res wands and, you know, whatever it might happen to be. You know,
right.
I kind of know. And our forge too has a specific, you know, cost associated to forging items. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff like that.
So, have you had a problem with runaway bank accounts?
Not really. No, it's been everything's balanced itself out really well. I mean, now there's players who, I mean, literally play 16 hours a day. And they, you know, they'll go farming for hours on end and hours on end. And if I see that they got some extra change in the pocket, hey, I understand that because I see them on all the time. And they're building their account up. That's fine. If that's what you want to do, fine. But I really haven't seen too many instances where, you know, players are just getting unusable amount of gold.
Yeah.
It always stays reasonable. And the number one reason for that is because everything costs what it should. Like, if they want certain things for their character, boy, they're going to pay for it. You know, it's going to be worth their time and investment and playing time.
Stuff that gets used a lot should be cheaper. Stuff that's more powerful should be more expensive. You know, it's an important thing to balance that out.
Yep.
That's one of the big bugaboos I had about some of the servers I went to, too, is that there was not a balance between XP and GP. And so either one of two situations happen. Either you're leveling faster than you could buy the equipment that you need, and in order to get the equipment that you need, you had to go pound on, you know, rats for 10 hours, getting zero experience point, really low experience point, you know, to build your gold supply ups.
Yep.
So that you could afford that gear before you leveled and it was useless to you again. And I think that's probably what I see more often than the other way around, which is where you end up with so much gold that you can buy the moon.
Yeah.
You know, at level 2, you have everything maxed out. You know, there's certainly a balance that that isn't looked at often enough in a lot of worlds.
I spent a lot of time, like I could tell you now when we first started, things were a little off kilter. I mean, it was a little bit gold heaven early on. But
it's real easy to make Monty Hall. It really is.
Oh, yeah. And what I did was I spent a lot of time in between the rollouts of our chapters to our story. I would go back and take a brand new, fresh character and run it through from the beginning, grab a few people with me, you know, check out how much gold I was getting, what I was going to have to buy, and seeing how many times, hey, you go through an area and you're sucking down potions to stay alive, it's costing you. So if you're not pulling in enough bread to compensate for what you're losing to get through to that end of that objective. You know,
and profit a little bit, too. You have to profit a little bit because the next level, the gear is going to be more expensive.
Yep, exactly. You have to have a profit. Otherwise, what's the sense of running it? It's no fun at all if you're running through. You know, you're not making anything.
Yeah, like I said, what you end up doing is you end up going back to the lower level areas and beating on low-level rats for a while to get the gold, and it's not a very fun thing to do, you know?
No, not at all. Not at all. That's why...
It takes a long time, too. You have to kill a whole lot of rats to do it.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. You know, I mean, from a user, you're right, from a user perspective, that's ridiculous. Right. I mean, I think that the bottom line is, you know, when I went back through and did that type of testing, detailed, myself as the builder, it really opened my eyes exactly what I had to do to get it right. And once I did that, we've been perfect since then. It's been, players are happy. You don't see runaway bank accounts. Stuff still has value.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of new builders don't realize how much the value of an item increases when you put like a magical ability on something. You know, that's something that struck me when I first did it is, wow, I just put that one little +1 to attack on there, and all of a sudden the weapon, like, 5 times more expensive to, you know,
that's
all at that store. And it was, and I think a lot of people don't realize that when they start putting those more powerful items in, that they really, really gets the value of things going up, you know, and you need some way to keep that from getting out of control.
Yeah, that's the fact that a lot of people, you're right, people don't realize that all that value is coming from a cost 2DA file. You can tweak it, but there comes a little bit of a problem with that too, because the more you mess around with stuff, it could bite you in the rear end. You fix one thing, you break 20 other things that are based on it.
True.
On that.
That's why we're not the programmers at BioWare.
So, do you do anything to help limit that? Like have your? I played this one module where there was in the town there was this pickpocket guy, NPC guy, who would cruise around the town, and if he detected that you had a certain amount of gold more than you should at your level, he would pick your pocket and take it away from you. Another thing they had there was the merchant would adjust his cost based on your gold supply.
That's
so
evil.
When you went to the merchant, he would charge you more for things if you had a lot of gold. I thought those were interesting ways of trying to maintain that balance and keeping the
That's simply evil.
Yeah, it's evil.
Well, There's a couple things to look at. You're right. That is a way to handle if you do have a situation where, you know, players are accumulating enough gold to buy the realms. You know, the other way you do it is you give them other things to do. Like, for instance, like on our server, we have guilds that people can actually upload areas to our server and then we'll actually, you know, put them in for them. They can donate real money for it, or they can actually use in-game gold to purchase their guild hall. You know, it's either customary or one that we do for them as a template. And one of the nice things about it is that it gives a player an ability to accumulate X amount of gold over X amount of time, and then, you know, they can use that gold to purchase their guild hall, which is like almost like they're building it, they're buying a plot of land in the game. And that's been something that really went over well with the players, because, you know, even if they do get to the certain point where they make it to the end of our campaign and they're epic level 4 and, You know, they're really going through stuff. You know, they have that extra thing that they could do with their bread instead of just, you know, tossing it down to another player or, you know, starting a new character up. They actually can be, you know, really improve their RP and their all the other stuff just with their gold that they have accumulated.
Yeah. Now, do you restrict players from tweaking their other characters?
You mean like going?
You know, like they'll have a level 10 guy with 10,000 gold, and he'll put the 10,000 gold on the ground and then log in as another guy and pick it up.
Well, actually,
or give it to somebody and hand it over. You know, tweak their other character.
No, we don't.
Because that really screws up the economy.
That is a bannable offense on Avalis. You will be instantly banned from mulling gold or items.
Okay. Yes. Well, we actually are banned.
Hey, I guess that's pretty solid right there.
Yeah.
Don't do it on Avalis.
Yep. No, we're the exact opposite of ROT. I mean, we allow transfer of gold from player to player. Well, it doesn't matter because they have their account. Their bank account is done by the player, not by the character. So they can transfer, you know, if they've accumulated the gold, that's their gold.
That's a really interesting way to do it, huh?
Yep. We haven't had any problems doing it. Players love it. I mean, you know, no reason why, you know, there's no surprise why, you know, we're the top-rated NWN2 server. You know, they love it. I mean, people come in, they can't believe that we allow to do it. But, you know, hey, we have things about items, though. You know, you can't be mulling items over and things like that. But gold, hey, you know, you earn the gold at your account. You can, if you want to sprinkle a little extra gold to your brand new character, that's fine. But because of the how long it takes for you to level your character and, you know, the time that you put into your character, that gold really is only going to help you so much. You still have to go through the story. You still have to go through the adventure. And, you know, there's a lot to it, more than that, though, for our server.
Well, as long as you have a limit in place, you know, you have an account-wide limit, that's a good way to go.
It's
the servers that have no limit that it really throws things off.
No limit.
Oh, true.
Like on your world, if I give money from character A to character B, then character A has less money. In a lot of worlds, that isn't the case.
Oh no, you're absolutely right. There's an absolute amount of gold. You're not getting no freebies.
Yeah.
Uh-uh.
How is the balance over on your server, Spool?
You know, player economy, I think, is like the biggest challenge that we have.
Yeah. It's tough.
It really is. We've been around for a very long time. So we have a lot of, items that dropped in the first 5-6 weeks of the world ever being up that were subsequently banned forever. So we've done item buybacks and that sort of thing over time. What we try to do is we try to find ways to add value for people who created themselves a lot of gold. We allow player housing, of course, and that's pretty expensive. Guild housing, so you can build areas for your guilds. We also have a pretty robust player economy based off of the crafting system and drops and recycling, all that sort of thing. So you can purchase a merchant, and we try to find ways to offer gold sinks where you get some value out of it. Like the merchants for player merchants are all menu driven, but they only hold a certain number of items. You can hold a maximum of 35 inventory squares, and then if you want more space on your merchant, you got to spend more money to get so that he can hold more stuff.
The player accumulates the money that the merchant makes when he sells stuff?
That's right. We try to aim as close toward the player economy as we can. So that is a character in the game.
You don't have a problem with runaway bank accounts doing that?
It's a challenge. We definitely have to find ways for characters to spend their gold. And we have a few people who have millions of gold right now.
Huh.
But they earned it. They earned it by taking that gold from other people. So what we try to do is we try to think about any interaction between two players is basically neutral in the world. What we need to look at from the team standpoint is gold faucets, places where gold is entering the economy. For example, if you turn in some items and an NPC pays you for them, that's a gold faucet.
Right.
And then we look for gold sinks, places where money exits the world completely. For example, if you buy a player house, that money is gone because right. the team takes it away. And so any money that moves around inside the player economy, with one guy selling a sword, one guy's buying it, we don't care about how much it goes for. That economy is set by the demand in the world. So what we try to do is we try to make more sinks than faucets, so that we don't have runaway inflation where a gold piece isn't worth anything. But I mean, over the course of 4 years, 5 years, your money doesn't buy as much as it used to. That's just kind of the way that the world has gone.
The best, I don't know, you said about players buying their own houses. I used to play on the server that actually taxes the houses for, you buy the, and you have taxes, where you have a flag in front of a house that you have to, at least twice a month, real world, to pay a tax for it.
Most of our players use inn rooms instead of building their own house. So you rent a room at an inn, and in order to get the door open, you got to pay like 1,000 gold a week. So, you know, and it's some of them are cheap rundown, dives, and they're only 500 a week. Some of them are 3,000-4,000 a week for the prestigious rich guy inn room. So that's just a place with a chest to store your stuff and a small room. So I think most players end up using the inns. Buying a player house can run you. The player house for my main character cost, before I joined the team, so I guess it cost us 900 grand. Took us about 8 months of trying to develop the goal plus borrowing money from other people to do it.
Wow.
I never had a problem like that on any server I played.
I mean, I'll tell you what, the player guilds and the things like that, they do add a lot of personality to the server. I mean, we have about 5 or 6 prominent ones. We have about 12 altogether, but it's 5 or 6 prominent guilds. And I tell you what, it really does, it amazes me on how much it adds to the server before we actually had people who, did the buy-ins to get their own guild halls and for RP and just that extra little character to the story. It is something.
Yep, it makes a difference for your guild to have some place to go that's theirs.
Exactly.
It really is hard though, trying to manage an economy when you've got a lot of players, a lot of servers, a lot of quests that give rewards out. Mm-hmm. To not have inflation just run away with everything. It's something that we really, really, really think about. Every time we add a new recipe to the crafting system, you wonder what it's going to do to the economy when it first comes out. People are having to invest tons and tons of gold into learning it and developing, getting the components, and then as they build more and more of them, of course the prices begin to drop because items don't go away. When somebody buys a ring, they don't need that ring again. They either pass it on or they don't. But those items don't get consumed. You buy a +2 strength ring, it doesn't wear out.
Now, on the other side of the economy issue, from the gold is also the items. Now that you brought that up, there are item faucets and item sinks too, right?
We're very careful about that on Avalis because we're low magic. Getting a +3 weapon is a challenge. Getting a +4 weapon is extremely rare.
So you destroy items like that when they're sold?
We don't. They don't drop. You can't get a +3 item in a drop on our world. You'll either the absolute very pinnacle of the crafting, and I don't think we have a character right now that's reached the top level. We'll let you create it. Otherwise, it's going to be DM rewards, basically.
Right.
But
if somebody decides to sell it,
if they sell it.
Let it sit in the store.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. And
the gold
wait, no. On the bio merchants? No, that gets destroyed.
Yeah, okay.
But if they sell in the player economy, it sits there until, I mean, if they put it on their own merchant, then it's on their merchant.
Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, until somebody else buys it. And those items that don't drop command a whole lot of money.
But those merchants that you're talking about, those are only accessible by PC.
That's
right?
Correct, yeah. That's owned by a player character and accessible by other characters when they walk into a shop.
I see.
Yeah, BioWare merchants aren't like that at all, but we really try to minimize those because they tend to be terrible, terrible gold faucets.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. They're horrible. They really screw things up.
They work off toolset value.
It's too bad the real world doesn't have more of that.
We had, you know, issues where one guy crafts 1,000+1 acidic daggers and acid happens to have a high toolset value, and so he can just rake it in.
Yeah.
Until we discover that that sort of thing is happening, and then have to go fix the merchant. We really try to trend away from BioWare's default merchant scripts whenever possible.
There's a couple
that happens with Obsidian's merchants too.
Well, I don't know if you guys know about the continual light thing that went on for a while, where you could buy a plain dagger or something and throw a continual light spell on it
and then sell it back for
10 times what you bought it for. You know?
God. Yeah, biomerchants. Yeah. What a mess. What a mess.
I remember that in Neverwinter 1. There would be those light gems. And, you know, when I first started playing on Arion, you know, I found that, you know, merchant at one end of the realm that sold light gems, you know, and they were like cheap. They were like, you know, 25 gold a piece.
Yeah.
You know, and then I'd go buy a bunch of hand axes or picks or some stupid crap like that. And I'd rent the hotel room and I'd sit there and I'd apply gemstones, the light gems, to every, you know, to a bag full of weapons and then go back and sell them all at, like, you know, 10 times what I had in it.
Oh, what a disaster. Yeah, that's exactly the sort of thing we try to stop whenever possible.
Yeah, I had to be careful, too. When we first rolled out, we used Charlie's item modifier for Neverwinter 2.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of holes in that thing, man. There was like holes like where you could actually, when you put the unlimited item, like an unlimited arrows bow on, it would make this item in your inventory that was unlimited, arrows or whatever. And people would actually go forge that unlimited item and then sell it, because it was a free item, and they would get, like, the ridiculous amount of gold back every time they do it. So they basically had unlimited gold. We caught on to that pretty quick, but there was stuff like that we didn't know up front. There's holes like that, and we just had to go through. Then that cost yours truly here about another couple weeks of painfully going through every option to figure out exactly what you could do and couldn't do.
Yeah.
And you have to fix the code. I spent too much time recoding all that stuff because it was whole city.
Oh yeah, it was. We figured out real quick. People were taking plot items, you know, which no merchant would buy. They'd go and run it through the appearance modifier, which would remove the plot flag, and then they'd go hot footing it down to the store.
Wow.
You know, so like we spent a couple weeks pulling our hair out, going, how the hell are they selling these things? They're flat. How are they doing this? You know, and then we figure it out, and it's like, oh, geez.
Yep.
You know, you can, no matter what you anticipate, you can never fully comprehend what some other player is going to come up with.
Yeah, what a disaster.
Darn it.
Those players.
You can't live with them. We cannot live without them.
Our world would be bug free if we didn't have players.
You probably got the worst pool though. You got tons of players on your stuff. I mean, you have so many servers and everything. You probably get all kind of stuff going.
We do, yeah. I mean, we really do. It's cut down some now, but we've got, I mean, a couple hundred active people, and you know. God, it's spread across so much area. We have a few scripts that we can use that will let us just look through the modules, but we finally got the hang a handle on it after, I guess, a year or so of the new QA process. Back in the old days, in the bad old days, where everybody kind of, each module coordinator had its own, was kind of run by its own person, and there was no unifying design philosophy and no real build restrictions on things like merchants in the module and that sort of thing, and so it was quite a challenge to try and chase down all those problems. We get it better now because nothing gets in until it touches the QA server first. But yeah, we still have the occasional issue, the occasional caustic daggers.
Oh, poor.
Nah. Okay, so I think we are here for two. We have a recorded two. Okay, we have 2 hours of recording here. Nice recording. A lot of stuff. Anything more to add to the world builders?
Actually, there is one other topic I like to talk about, and that's the realism that I talked about in that post. I don't know if you guys read that, but
yes.
One of the things that I saw when I went out there is that a lot with the new CEP and Project Q and all these custom content add-ons that are coming on, there's been a real push on the builder's part to create realistic worlds that are really over-realistic.
Yeah.
In the sort of a you-must-eat-or-you'll-starve sort of a way?
Those kind of things, yeah. You know, just looking for, you know, death to be death.
Yeah, so they death.
Make, so they make you sit in the realm of death for 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah, I think some of it's overkill.
Yeah, there's a trade-off there between realism and fun.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, we don't do you must have a bedroll to rest, though we do have restable and non-restable areas. We don't do you must have food in order to regain health. We don't do any of that stuff. I mean,
it's, and the reason you don't?
It's annoying.
Your players don't like it.
Yeah.
No, they don't. They're having to carry around a bedroll, and our players don't like anything in their inventories that's not useful.
Yeah.
I mean, every widget annoys the crap out of them, so we don't want to have to make people carry around a bedroll or pack food in order to go out on an adventure. I mean, it just shouldn't be that realistic.
No.
I agree with that.
Permadeath, same thing. I think it's just, who wants to invest time in a character only to risk dying? All you do is you become risk averse, so you don't go on adventures. So your content doesn't get used, and what's the point?
Well, I played on such server for 7 months until I lost the character and said, the hell with it. I do not have time to start a new one.
Yeah, I mean, we do death like first 4 levels. Basically, you do your little quest and get out. Done. No penalty, no XP pain, anything like that. After that, you lose 50 XP per level if you take a res dead. if you get resurrected, you gain all your XP back. If you get raised, you don't gain all your XP back.
If you respawn.
Or you can just do your quest and exit out, and you appear back in the temple with all your XP back. I mean, we really don't want to. We don't want to punish people that badly. The fact that you've died, I think the fact that you've died is annoying enough. Plus, the fact that you're going to have to rearrange your inventory is also super annoying. And that's plenty, in my opinion. Yeah. Just having to dump all your quick slots and re-add them in. Is enough of a punishment.
I think sometimes this is where like when on Axe's post about the disconnect going on there between players and builders, some of these systems, they sound real cool in theory, but when you're actually playing, you know, it's more of an annoyance. You know, I mean, we all have real lives and jobs and stuff like that going on. You know, most of us play just, you know, to get away. It's an escape, all right? And, you know, we don't need a second job or career, otherwise we'd have one that pays. you know, I personally, I like to keep my fantasy and my reality separated as far apart as I can.
Seriously.
Here, here.
Absolutely.
The thing that kills me the most is getting into a world and it seems like it's all medieval and everything, and then you talk to some NPC who's using, you know, some rap lingo or something modern, you know, it just throws everything off, you know?
Well, I think that's a whole other topic for another day about quality of style production.
Yeah.
I think that's a place there, but, you know.
Internal consistency. Suspension of disbelief is critical, I think.
Yeah,
well, that's a very much of a buildery topic. So your DMs can screw it up too. That's part of training a DM staff, I guess, is reminding them that they need to pay attention to internal consistency, that they shouldn't be spawning monsters on top of your players, because the players don't understand where they came from. I mean, 14 bears don't appear out of thin air. They need to appear off the edge of the viewable site and then charge. Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. And
my personal favorite is open a door and then behind the door, like you throw a bunch of murderers come flying out the door. You know, that's my personal favorite. You got to open the door first with your invisible DM character. You know, just to give them the effect that the door was kicked open or something. You know.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And you need to pay attention as a DM. If the PCs have cleared out that corridor, you shouldn't be spawning things in it again. They just cleared it out. If there's no reason for monsters to be there, you shouldn't throw them in there to spice it up. You've got to think about structure of the dungeon they're in and where things are supposed to be coming from and what's appropriate for the area.
What just happened?
Yeah, it's one of the things. You always like the proverbial sewer crawl or a crypt crawl. You always try to hit and run with monsters around the corner. You know, out of their view site. Or behind, you know, coming up from behind them. You don't just drop them right in on top of them.
Yeah. And if your party goes in and clears out a room and shuts the door behind them when they leave, stuff shouldn't come out of that door anymore. That room's clear. And you got to move on. Unless there's another entrance. Right. It has to make sense. It has to be internally consistent. Because otherwise your players... They might go back and search for the secret entrance, and if there isn't one, then they go, oh, the DM was being an ass.
Yeah.
Either
that or they
don't need an excuse for that.
That doesn't necessarily have to be that. I mean, they could decide, well, I guess I just don't have the skills to find it.
Yeah.
How many times
does
this happen?
People will assume. They'll assume that the DM was being an ass. You definitely want to try and maintain that level of internal consistency and that suspicion.
What you should do is if there is a secret door there and they didn't find it and they're blaming you for it, you ought to try and kind of guide them back in there sometime.
Start
so they can find it when they do have the skills and then they can apologize to you.
Or at least start demanding roles and tell them, you know, you don't find anything this time.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. You know, give them a hint that there's something there.
Right.
Save.
You know, even if there isn't something there. That'd be a good way to have the monsters come out of that room they just cleared, if you could hint to them that, oh, there is something else there, but you didn't find it, you know.
Exactly.
Even if there isn't one there.
If your players trust you, then you can do that, and it will suggest to them that they missed something.
Yeah.
But if they don't trust you, then they'll go, oh, you're just being an ass.
Yeah.
So you have to build up that thing where if you maintain the suspension of disbelief, then when things act in ways that the players think they shouldn't be, then they can safely assume there must be some in-character reason for this. We should go investigate it.
Yeah.
That brings me to another question, though. I was wondering, how often, I guess, and how much do you guys allow players in your events to actually completely, totally fail?
I'll let the whole party get wiped if they're dumb enough to do something that deserves it.
Same here.
You know, I mean, you know, honestly, I will allow their actions to have consequences.
Yeah, I feel like it's really important. I wonder, though, how, I mean, because I know there are some DMs who are really they're reluctant to have the event fall apart completely. You know, your party all died, or they never found the bad guy. The kid is dead. The mother is still grieving. You saved nothing. you guys just failed.
You have all the NPCs give them shit about it?
Yes!
Yeah, that's a good way to go.
A lot of DMs are reluctant to do that, though. They'll give you an out. They'll give the players the bad guy will wipe the floor with them, and then they'll give them some way to recover and still win the day. And I wonder how much people do that as opposed to going ahead and letting people just get killed or get mobbed or whatever.
A lot of times when I'm running, especially in an RP event, I let the players, I throw the NPCs, I go in and I get things going and I give them clues, and then the players have to work it out amongst themselves what their next direction is. All right. So, when I plan for the event, I got to allow some leeway and try to anticipate, several different base directions things could go. But, if the group doesn't work together well and they just completely fall apart as a team and, they just come up empty-handed, and that's the way, the event ends up. If they run themselves into a corner like that and there's nowhere else for them to go and they don't work it out, the event kind of ends.
Right.
I try to set it up to let them make the decisions and let them lead themselves.
Now, if that happens and it's all over, do you still reward them?
Yeah, but not as much.
Let's say you get XP always. The DM that taught me how to do this back in 04, the DM that taught me how to be a DM, he had a philosophy that in a DM event, all players should leave with more experience than they arrived with. No matter what happens, no matter how badly they fail, no matter how much they die, at the end of the event, you should always have more XP than when you started.
Yeah, pretty much.
You gain experience by experiencing things, so
that makes
total sense to me that you should always get experience. Here is, on another related topic, quests. A lot of quests in modules are set up to give experience and gold together, and that's one good way to get that economy balance worked out, is by giving a quest that just gives experience and another one that just gives gold. So if your XP gold piece balance is out of whack, you can go somewhere and fix it.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Finding other ways to reward characters is good. We have a couple of quests that don't give you anything new, no items, and no gold, but they will, the reward at the end is the dwarf will add a stat to your item. They'll give you another +2 of your maximum stat, or something like that. Give me that ring, I'll add something new to it, and that'll be your reward.
Same thing with our server, and we have something new we just added, we call the Wish Shards. Kalma came up with it, and what it is that for DM events, we are going to be handing out wish shards, which could be, by the player, they could be used to get so much gold per level, so much experience per level, or if you collect enough up, you can get certain things that you can't get in the server otherwise, like maybe a couple extra pluses here and there, or a stat here and there, and let the player decide how they're used, but they're not real drop items. So, it's stuff that's not a gold particularly, and we don't give that much gold out with them, but the other features are not... not gold and item based. They're more that the player would like to have, and stuff that you it's great for their participation. And that does seem to really work out well too. Yeah.
And to be perfectly honest, I basically stole the idea from another world. I saw how they had used basically a very similar setup, and Brian and I tossed it back and forth, and we just expanded it to tailor it more to what we needed for our world situation. And, it worked out pretty good.
Yeah, I think any kind of non-traditional rewards you can give to your characters are important.
Well, one of the things that bothered me, I can think of one world, what's his name? It's like one of, Arabelle, something like that. It's one of the ones that's always on the top of the list. They have a quest in the first town that you get to. There's a quest where you can deliver a bunch of messages around town, you know? You go in and do this, deliver this over to this guy, and you come back and get another one and go deliver over there. And they give experience for that. And, I don't know. If running across town and delivering a letter really is worth experience. experiencing something, but it's something
you're gonna
that
be
you're not really learning much from, you know? You shouldn't get experience.
Yeah. You're gonna
that's
be relegated
kind of
to a...
That's the kind of quest that's perfect for gold only.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. If you're relegated to being a medieval FedEx guy, you should be getting, you know, medieval gin for it.
You should, yeah.
And
is there any server that doesn't do that? The little FedEx quests?
We don't.
Well, not that common, really. From what I saw, I didn't see that many.
Really?
Not a lot of places do it.
I personally always hated that, you know, especially it was really prevalent in Neverwinter 1 years ago when I was playing the game. You know, just about every world I went to, you almost always started off as some kind of vermin exterminator or a package deliverer. You know, I got tired of killing the rats in Grandma's basement, and I got tired of taking a broken sword hilt over to the forge to be fixed.
I think every server has that stupid rat quest.
On our NWN2 server, we actually turned that into a joke on Avalis 2. You can go into the tavern in the main city, and the guy will be like, "Oh, we have rats. We need you to exterminate." And you go down, and they're just normal, like, little tiny rats. And then when you come back up, all the NPCs laugh at you. Like, "Ah, ha, ha, the new guy fell for the rat quest thing. That was hilarious."
Well, for you builders out there that are looking to have an actual quest with the actual encounters. You know, you can put rats down there, and then once you put them down there, you can change their appearance to something else, and they'll still be like rats, but they'll look different, and it makes a big difference, you know? Make them snakes, you know? Make them tiny little baby dragons, anything but rats.
Kind of a rat. Spider.
Spider.
A spider, I guess.
Mm. Rats and spiders. Yep.
I say throw something weird down there. You know? Something they're not going to expect. It's the first quest of the module, you know, usually. It's the first thing you do, so.
I don't know.
Should be something interesting, should be something successful.
Anytime I go to a world.
Run into some bears in the sewer. Bears that die from one hit, just like the rats do. You know, it's just something that would be unique and different and interesting.
More interesting
than rats in the sewer or the boat or whatever it is.
I put leeches in the sewers.
Leeches.
There you go.
Leeches, that's a good variation there. Snakes would be good, I guess, if you're looking for realism type stuff. Like I say, for the first quest of the module, first thing that players see should be something interesting. Something that's successful and interesting and makes them go, "Oh wow, that was different." This module,
yeah, something that makes people go, "Hey, this is different." You got to have that hook.
Kick them off on something good right away, you know, and you'll be able to keep your player base a lot more than, you know. I played on this one module where they had the rat quest, but they made the rats so tough that, you know, I could never make it through. And it took me a long time to do it, and they also, they had a rest system that was like, you know, you had to wait for 35 minutes.
35 real-life minutes? Rest,
and, yeah, 35 real-life minutes.
Holy crap.
Before you could rest again. And, you know, it was a heavy role-playing server, and there was people in the town all over the place you could role-play with, so at least there was something to do. But I mean, I was just trying to get through the first quest and get my guy to level 2, you know, and I couldn't make it through the rats in the cellar, and I could, and I had to wait to rest. And not only did you have to wait to rest, but you couldn't rest anywhere. You had to go to the inn and rest. And in order to go to the inn and rest, they charged you money to rent the room.
So, it's
everything that I picked up in the dungeon fighting the rats when I lost, I ended up spending on the inn room so I could sleep and get and heal up again. And then I didn't have enough money to buy the potions that I needed to survive again. And so it was this like never ending spiral of doom down to get able to finish. It was a real headache. And finally I got somebody else to give me some money.
We try to aim people towards the into the player economy as quickly as we can. One of the critical new player quests on the Avalis One server is it used to be I've lost my daughter in this cave full of fire beetles, and after years of that happening, we let the daughters grow up, and now they say, "Oh God, our old father—he's lost in the fire beetle cave." But you harvest the bellies out of the fire beetles and sell them to this kid who will turn them into fire potions for you, and that's a pile of XP. And some gold, and also the fire potions are critical in the player crafting economy, so lots of other players will buy them from you as well.
That's the first quest.
That's actually a multi-server quest if you want to maximize your gold for it. But yes, that is just about the first quest that you run across.
That's a really good one because it's a good successful one, and it's not a rat quest, you know.
Yeah,
fire beetles are getting close to being like a rat quest.
They are.
But you know, at least it's not a rat quest.
And
you get something out of it.
You do, and you can make a pile of cash as a low level character. Of course, you're going to consume a lot of it on healing kits and that sort of thing. But you can end up turning a profit, and it is a profit in the player economy, which means other people are getting the fire potions they need in order to do crafting.
That's what's called the perfect money sink or something. Or nearly perfect money sink.
Yes.
Not many people get enough money, but we get enough to get to do what we need to.
Yeah, you don't want to get rich off of fire potions. but you do want to be able to be rich enough to buy some healing kits and save a little extra cash, you know, cover the cost of your in room, buy the potions you need, and still maybe save up for that for that next item you want to buy.
Wow. Okay. So anything else on the topic?
Not that I can think of.
All right. So I think we had a good 2.5 hours.
It was fantastic. Yeah.
Let's see how Trey will handle it in the how many shows. We will see you. Okay, we will see you around and have a nice day. Thanks for coming.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, bye-bye. Good talking with you.
Later. Take care, everyone. Hope we should do this again sometime.
All right.
This is Striker B, ending the broadcast.
Well, and we're back. And now, we've got news. No, wait a minute. We don't have any news. Someone promised me news. I think I'm going to have to eat the person who promised me the news and didn't bring any. I could make something up. No. I think I'll just continue talking to myself here and wondering what the meaning of life is and what the tail speed of a swallow flying over Houston on the way to some far distant shore might be. I know. I'll just say good night. And in the meantime, everybody get in game and level up.
You can always reach us via our website at neverwinternightspodcast.com or by email at show@neverwinternightspodcast.com. You can also leave an audio comment or listener hello by calling us on Skype. Just call NWN Podcast, all one word. The opinions and viewpoints expressed on the Neverwinter Nights podcast are not necessarily those of its sponsors or those of Obsidian, BioWare, Atari, their partners, or employees. The Neverwinter Nights podcast is a production of These Old Geeks, who is solely responsible for its content.
For now, I say we crack some of those kegs and drown the flagon in wine.
The Neverwinter Nights podcast.
The Neverwinter Nights podcast is copyright 2010.